the optimal life.
I believe you.
I don't know why I would do that to myself to start off the episode by setting the bar so high and saying this will be the best interview ever.
That is a high bar because we've had plenty of interviews now.
You have. I've seen you guys going around and hitting different podcasts and talking with a lot of different people. So I'm glad to talk to the two of you. I'm just curious, how do you come together to co-author a book? How does that even work? How does the idea formulate? And then how do you actually execute on doing this together?
Our relationship started in that we are both emergency medicine physicians, we're both medical educators, and we both completed fellowship training in bedside ultrasound. So we were in each other's worlds. Also, geographically, we had overlaps in terms of New York City and Boston. When the pandemic hit, Dara and I were on a conversation, and she has developed and was ongoing developing her expertise in mentorship. And we had a conversation by phone, maybe it was by Zoom, like, do you think I can write about this and make this one of my things and you know, academically develop this? And I said, definitely. And then offhandedly, I said, you know, if you ever want to write together, let me know. Because I, on my own personal professional journey, had been working on writing and writing with people. And we started writing together. She followed up and drove some ideas of some articles. And so we had a proof of concept of, okay, we can write together. And we have had some of the same, some different, some very overlapping experiences learning how to navigate the workplace, how to be better. And she came to me and said, you know, I want to write a book. I'm like, that's awesome. Yes, go for it. And she said, no. Do you want to write it with me? And I didn't even have to think long. I was like, you know what? I'm on board. Yes, let's do it. And so we had had experience writing together. We both felt it was important to share what we had learned with a broad audience on the workplace, because both of us had wished we had learned certain things sooner, easier, more efficiently. And that's our goal.
Mm. So how does that unfold then, practically speaking? Generally speaking, do you guys start pinging back drafts to each other, ideas? I'm just trying to understand, because that seems like it'd be a very hard thing to accomplish.
Writing a book is a very big lift. The whole process started about 3 years ago. I was on maternity leave with my third child when I was like, I really want to write a book. I want to do something different. I spent some time reading about writing and about the book writing process a little bit before I went to RESA. But it was a goal that I had had for a long time. And it was such a large undertaking that I'm glad I didn't do it alone. As far as the mechanics, you know, like Risa had said, we had been writing articles before, so we really understood, you know, the use of Google Docs, and we were very comfortable with each other's editing style, which is really important when it comes to writing with someone and welcoming and trusting their edits, because, you know, when you write something, it's a very vulnerable thing to do. And so if someone comes in and like chops it all away, you don't want to be insulted. You want to know that this person is doing it to make the piece better. And so we already had that established level of trust. When it comes to writing a book, we actually focused very heavily first on the table of contents. We had initially these like very vague topics. We read a lot of books about table of contents and how important it is for the chapter title as well as the subtitles to be very descriptive of what it is, especially for nonfiction. And so we spent probably a few months or so working on the table of contents, meeting with people, running through the table of contents with others to see if we're missing any gaps. And from there, we just started writing chapters. I think we did it where it was like, I was going to do chapter one and then do the first draft, and she would do chapter two. And then we would sort of swap and read each other's edits. And we did that back and forth many, many times until we got the first draft. But that whole process takes, you know, especially for busy professionals, we were both working clinically as well. So that took about 2 years.
That's incredible. And here we are getting close to April 16th launch date. We're talking about the book Micro Skills. So what exactly does that mean, ladies, Micro Skills?
We're often asked, what is a microscale? How do you define it? And it is a bit what it sounds like. These are small, concrete, fundamental steps that add up to be large goals, large projects, large habits, large even innate character traits that we actually say are not innate traits. These are all learnable. So it's more a way of thinking. When something seems overwhelming in the workplace, teaching the reader, the audience, the listener, how to break it down into these fundamental building blocks. And these building blocks are transferable, they're additive, and they don't just stay under the chapter of one microskills. You actually acquire them as you learn them real time, and you see how you start applying them into other aspects of the workplace.
What would be some examples then that you guys highlight in the book? What are some of the, you know, three or four that come to mind?
You know, for the chapter, for instance, on self-care, that's what we open the book with. We have a section on nourishing the people you trust, nourishing the relationship, excuse me. On the chapter on self-care, chapter one, microskills for self-care, we have microskills on nourishing the relationships with people you trust and value. We have a microskill on deliberate rest, on a microskill on taking care of your physical health, you know, seeing a primary care doctor, another on your financial health, because we know that burnout is related to this sort of sense of obligation with working, and that's largely related to your financial freedom. Mm. We have a microskill on taking tasks off your plate that don't bring you any joy. All of this sort of is under the umbrella of self-care, because when someone says to you, hey, you need to go work on your self-care or your ability to take care of yourself, you might not know the mechanics of doing that. It might not be clear because it wasn't modeled or very deliberately described to you in detail. Risa and I really wanted to sort of craft this book to be full of the details, because from our own personal experience, especially as early career professionals, you know, we had lofty goals just like everyone else. I think what we recognized was that some people around us had the keys to, you know, the secret castle or passage where they can get all of the answers. The playbook is how we call it. And we did not. I did not. It took me a lot longer to figure out all of the details of how to succeed. And the story we give often, that I give often, is when I was interested in sort of going to the next step of my career, like getting a promotion or an award or a grant, some sort of recognition for all the work I was doing, I noticed that my peers were getting these left and right, and I wasn't, even though I was doing, you know, I thought quality work. And so I finally asked a peer, like, how are you finding all of these people to nominate you and put you forward and do all of this, you know, highlighting of your work? How are you finding people who are willing to do all of that for you? And he responded by just saying, Adara, I'm actually the one driving all of this myself. I write my nomination letters. I ask them to sponsor me. I find the opportunities myself. It's all on me to do this. And as obvious as that sounds, I did not know that. I just assumed that I could wait around and someone would come to me and, you know, say, hey, you look like you deserve this. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do this for you. And so that really, really small skill of just learning how to nominate myself and write my own, you know, draft my own letters of recommendation was a pivotal moment for me that really let me see that some people have these secret tricks of the trades given to them or shared with them, and some of us do not.
Well, that's interesting, because what you highlight there is something that's so simple that is just, hey, I just have to be proactive and take this into my own hands, instead of being reactive or non-active at all and expecting, hey, somebody else is going to come along and one day I'm going to get recognized. And I would imagine, Adara, that is a common trap or a common thought process or mindset, especially of young folks. Probably some of your students even at Harvard. I mean, I would assume that these are things that you're helping these young students now develop these mindsets at an early stage.
I mean, even if you were to be told you need to be more proactive, Like, what does that look like? Right. And so the idea of knowing, you know, we wrote our first, one of our first articles was on drafting your own letter of recommendation. And as simple as that is, I had no idea that was happening in the background and that other people were doing that as a means to lower the threshold for someone to support them. And so, yeah, a lot of this is assumed to be common knowledge, and yet many people don't know the details.
What's your introduction?
I'm sorry, Risa. Real quick, I'm just curious, though, back to the college student, your students at Harvard especially. You're dealing with some extremely brilliant minds, but what I often find is that these students, as smart and book smart as they are, they quite often lack, we'll call it social awareness, maybe some emotional intelligence skills. So how are you helping those folks bridge the gap using that high intellect, but saying, hey, you got to do more than just be book smart?
Yeah, this comes up often. I mean, it's really hard to teach situational awareness, emotional intelligence, all of those cues when it comes to like reading the room, because you're right. Taking a test is very different than reading a room and saying, hey, is this a good time for me to speak up? Am I bothering people? Am I showing too much initiative? Am I annoying someone? I mean, a lot of that is just really tough. And I don't think it's strongly correlated with your, you know, academic intellect. Mm-hmm. In the book, we talk a lot about reading the room, understanding your audience, understanding what your questions are and making sure that they're very clear and direct. So we give a lot of solutions to this overall problem that I think what you're talking about is the Gen Z population, folks who grew up socializing in this digital world, right? So they didn't understand the benefits of body language and how body language is a great tool to communicate with others, and how you and I, you know, in high school, college, we were probably socializing all one-on-one, direct face-to-face, not necessarily over TikTok and all these things. And so when you take that same population and put them into the workplace, they might not have that skill set that we just happen to have through college and through high school. And so we actually talk a lot about body language, for instance, and how to interpret your own body language, how to interpret other people's body language. These are skills that are not taught in the classroom.
No, they're not taught at all. Risa, you were going to say something.
Yeah, just that your question you just asked is definitely not an elite college challenge only. Like, we see this generationally, and a lot of people ask, how is this book going to be relevant to the Gen Zers? Are they going to read this? And this is not a book that needs to be read cover to cover. It actually can be a manual, a toolkit. And we detailed the table of contents so people can flip to what's relevant. And not only are people, young professionals, socializing differently, they've been socialized differently. Many have not gone on their first job interview until graduate school or even later. So this business self-help, you know, ready for college, ready for the workplace, early career professional content of chapters, 10 chapters on microskills that we put together, we really think will speak to the people that may have missed some of those things. And again, I don't think it's just one community or one group. And in fact, in the introduction, circling back to another thing that you highlighted, we basically said to the reader, no one's coming to save you. No one's losing sleep over your presentation. No one's losing sleep if you're not getting promoted. This is you, and you have to be the one most concerned with your professional journey. And then we discuss three truths. Time can only be spent. Think of time as a currency. So think about how you're using your time, with whom you're spending your time. Learning is limitless if accessible. And finally, the world is not equal. We all start at different places. We all have different resources, different things we learn perhaps from parents or generationally. And one of the ways we think what we wrote is different is many just assume you know how to do things, similar to what Adara highlighted with the go out and just do it. And you're like, but how? So we really break these skills down to a little bit of a story to draw the reader in, personal. And these are real authentic situations Adara and I have experienced. We bring the reader in by talking about the skill, why it's important. Don't just adopt this and do this for the sake of it. We acknowledge, listen, we get it. This is hard. And this is why maybe you haven't learned about this, adopted this. And finally, we do critical actions, which are really actionable steps to tell the reader how.
Mm. Adira mentioned one of the first ones, I believe, in the self-care section was about caring for a loved one or nurturing, something along those lines. What was the micro skill for that particular example?
So we subscribe to, love the concept, even have a diagram in the book of this concept of the personal board of directors. We're not the only ones that talk about this. We didn't found it, although we're really onto the concept. We all need to nurture relationships and develop trusting relationships. And specifically, our lens is professionally. And what we describe is that, think of it as a table, a round table with open seats. Always there are open seats. People can join your board. People can leave your board. There are no term limits. Some people are with you for a day and sort of serve a purpose for an episode, for a coaching session. Some people are with you for a lifetime. They're your go-to people to call for finances, to call when you're just feeling down and out and you need someone to lift you up. This concept of the personal board of directors is how we talk about nurturing relationships, so you know that there are people you can go to in times of happiness and times of distress. And these aren't one-sided, take-for-granted relationships. These are relationships that go both ways. So not only are you thinking of them, but you want to make sure they know you're thinking of them as well.
So what would be the micro skill in that example? How do you nurture that type of relationship, for example?
You know, this particular skill is something we bring.
Wait a second. You're not going to tell me to go on TikTok and ping them like Adira was talking about, are you?
You know, that is one way to develop a relationship, actually. We do. We talk the reader through how to develop these people and bring them in. So one of the critical actions is to assess your needs. You know, who am I missing? What am I missing? What would I really love to have access to in terms of information, in terms of learning a skill? So we talk about assessing your needs. Then we talk about reaching out to people. And this kind of overlaps with a chapter 8 on growing your network, that people think they're starting from zero and they don't have anybody. And not only do they not have anybody, but they're not focused on what they want. So why should I reach out to people? I'll look really disorganized. And we're like, no. You can and you should reach out to people because they can help you focus. They can help you organize. And so there is the, think about people that are already in your network, potentially closer than, you know, peripheral and distant, but actually core to your people that you call. And then you can set up meetings. And how do you set up meetings? Well, you can send an email. You can send an email if you know someone, or say you don't know someone. Adira likes to talk about DMing people on social. I do the same. LinkedIn, back in the day when we were Twitter users, even Instagram, you can DM people. And sometimes it's not that you're going to become besties and have regular interactions. But there are people that slowly over time you build relationships. And that's the other thing. We talk a lot about organic building of people on your board and not forcing the relationship and actually assessing, you know, are both people interested in the relationship? And sometimes that's just not the case. Mm-hmm. So we really talk a lot about those social skills building.
What I find really fascinating talking to the two of you in a short period of time is that, again, back to the social awareness and emotional intelligence thing, most doctors, don't take this offensive, most doctors don't have a whole lot of those skills either. A lot of the doctors, again, have they're quirky. They're really great at what they do, but they're great when it comes to science. The two of you sound like I know you're emergency medical professionals, but you also have like this psychologist self-help field background to you. I mean, you guys are extremely unique. I find it fascinating. Where did this come from? Is this how the two of you were able to get along so well? I mean, where does this other side of you come from?
I think we're definitely thinkers. I think we are thoughtful and calculated and making sure that we are listening as much as we are speaking to other people. To your comment about doctors, you know, it's funny. I think a lot of that could be just the environment in which we work can limit our ability to connect. I'm just going to just give that disclaimer.
You're giving everybody an out. That's very nice.
I'm not everybody. I'm just saying that, you know, it's really tough being an emergency medicine doc, but right. you definitely can build a relationship of a rapport in a few seconds just by saying hello to people and eye contact. To your question, though, about why we do this, I think, you know, A, it's important as physicians, I think, to be writing this book, because a lot of business health self-help books are written by the corporate executives who are like all about the technical data, case series, so those studies, and this is how you can drive revenue right. for your company.
But McKinsey, that's not everyone. The McKinsey consulting
yeah,
types.
That's yeah, that's not yeah. everyone. Like the yeah. average person isn't running a startup, right? But Risa and I have a very human-facing job. You know, even though we are taking care of patients, we are in a very interdisciplinary customer service. How do we care for the human? That, like, that is the priority of our job. And we really wanted that to work into the book. That's why we opened the book with micro skills on self-care, because we have seen people on a day-to-day basis drive their health very poorly because they were so focused on money, income, their job, getting promoted. And so throughout this book, we talk a lot about understanding the self, making sure that you are in a good situation before you start prioritizing networking, before you start prioritizing building your brand, the next opportunity. Are you in a good situation? Is your health okay? Are you exercising? Do you have a primary care doctor? Like, those are really important things. And as doctors, we know all about burnout because we have very high rates of burnout. And a lot of that, again, comes from just sacrificing the self. So this book is really infused with the theme of success does not mean self-sacrifice. And yes, we are very thoughtful people. And I think that shines through in the book. And that when we write something, we're thinking about accessibility. Who's reading this? Are we making this large assumption about what privilege they have, how much money they have, what network they have? Because we know, as Risa said with the truths, not everyone is the same. And some people are really struggling. And so when we're writing this book, we try to be as thoughtful as you have, you know, detected us to be. We really want to make sure that it's, you know, a book that's full of strategy, but also sympathy and compassion.
And I'll add that curricula these days, you know, back in the day, if you were a pre-med in college, perhaps it wasn't allowed and you weren't encouraged to have the full liberal arts education. That's not the way a lot of college students are graduating these days. In fact, there is a push to encourage non-science, non-STEM for some people going into medical school. And then even in med school, the curricula have changed such that that patient doctor experience is now a longitudinal 4-year experience. And the skills of interviewing, the skills of connecting and listening, sit down. There's a lot of science and data now about developing that human connection. And so, you know, thank you for sort of the highlight that you noted regarding Adara and Risa, but we have a lot of thoughtful, kind, really good medical colleagues that are the same.
I'm curious, how do you handle losing a patient? What's the emotional reaction that you have, and how do you compartmentalize and deal with the family? I mean, that's a learned skill over time, and I'm sure it doesn't usually get any easier.
No, that never gets easy. I mean, I think you can build some skills around coping with the hardship of, you know, dealing with the patient in front of you who just lost their life, their family members, which is a whole different level of stress and communication skills, the team, because everyone who was in that room experienced the same pain and stress, yourself. And then honestly, there's like a different layer of your family who you come home to debrief and talk about. And there's like their own form of stress and coping too. I think one thing that has always helped me is just understanding that I don't have to deal with all of the emotions I'm having right now in the moment. And I can sort of let them slowly rise to the moment when I feel like it's a good time. And in the emergency room, it's really hard to let everything express itself in the most authentic way because there are other patients. Mm. You know, I had a death last month and it was like, you know, very traumatic. And also there was someone else who was really, really sick who also needed me right away. And so, you know, I still think about that patient, even though in the moment I probably didn't spend as much time as I do now thinking about the patient, because you have to sort of continue on. But I think doctors, as Risa said, doctors are very reflective, and we learn a lot about debriefing. And, you know, to my point earlier, it might not feel that way to patients when you see us moving so quickly, because that's a system issue, not necessarily a doctor issue, that sort of requires us to have that speed and cadence. But there's a lot of reflection and debriefing and processing that happens behind the scenes that I think many patients are not aware of.
I also think that different cases, different patient deaths hit you differently, depending on the circumstances, a child versus an elderly patient. It doesn't mean they get differential care, but your personal reaction may differ. And sometimes you don't even know, you don't see it coming, but it just haunts you and stays with you. What I'll also say is these sort of episodes and exposures can build up over time. Circling back to the book, chapter one, Microskills for Self-Care, healthcare is not the only industry that doesn't teach these skills, but certainly we're really a good example in terms of eating, sleeping, deliberate rest, as Adara mentioned. And this even circles back to the personal board of directors that we talked about a little earlier. You have to have your go-to people. You have to the best of your ability, take great care of self, because this is part of the work we do. But, you know, emergency medicine is different than other fields. And also, our success in writing the articles that are business self-help, how to be better at work, and even with this book, is that the themes and the workplace pain points in healthcare are very similar to those in law, in education, in finance, in fill in the blank. And so we're really glad to be putting this content out, because we think it'll resonate with everybody.
That's beautiful stuff. You mentioned sleep, and I know the two of you, through all the late nights and crazy shifts over the course of time, I believe you guys talk about sleep within the book. What are some of your little tips and tricks when it comes to getting a good night's rest?
You almost
Oh, go ahead, Risa. Go, please. I know you love
this one. I
was going
to say, well, no. Adara and I are really good at, like, sort of, you know, and it's almost like foreshadowing of us to talk about an article that we just put out in CNBC about 8 sleep tips. And those are woven into the micro skill of sleep. And I share a story about how I was very late to the believing in sleep is part of health and sleep hygiene is important. I thought burning the midnight oil was the way you do it. The more you work, the more you got done. And then partially through just aging, partially through reading, I really became fully on board with the importance of sleep. And many of us have had experiences finishing a night shift, driving home, hoping we wouldn't hit a stop sign or a red light. I just think it's funny. When I worked in Manhattan, I learned the hard way to not sit down on the subway, or I would wake up in Queens rather than making my stop in Manhattan. So a further challenge is that not sleeping and being able to get away with not a lot of sleep is almost rewarded, and people boast about it. So Adair and I both talk about the importance of sleep and what our tips and tricks are.
And you have one, Adara, can you give us a low-hanging fruit trick that we could use so I could actually sleep well tonight?
Well, one thing that I think people underestimate is the effects of food and beverage late at night. You know, eating a meal 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, right before you go to bed can really keep you up. I would say that's one thing, is to be very thoughtful about when you're eating and drinking, especially things that have caffeine or any. So for me, you know, at night, I stop eating around 7. And then I will have usually just warm beverages in the evening, like chamomile tea, or even just warm water with like lemon or warm water alone. And so pulling away the soda, sugary drinks just in general, and then, you know, foods that might be harder for you to digest is one very easy strategy. But we do caution in this article that, you know, there's no one size fits all for everyone, right? You might try that and it does absolutely nothing for you. But for me, that has been a big change. There are other things, like I do a lot of light exercise before I go to bed. And it's just literally just like moving my arms like this. And my goal is just to fatigue myself so that I'm more tired. I'm not trying to like rev up my heart rate or break out in a sweat. I'm just trying to, you know, weigh my muscles down a bit. I use a lot of like eucalyptus or lavender sprays as well, just because it's again, calming. Blackout lights are important too, avoiding screen time or anything that's like blue light emitting into your eyes. The idea is once you find a regimen that works for you though, you should stick to it because you'll get used to it. Just like my kids, like they are on the same sleep schedule and they know after this final step, it's bedtime. Just sort of getting used to that regimen has been very instrumental for me. And it's really hard as an emergency medicine doc. We get off at different times. So aside from those nights where I'm working until 1 a.m., the rest of the nights, I'm trying to go to bed at the same time and do the exact same regimen.
Mm. And that's the other thing. You got to come home after a long shift and you may have experienced a ton of trauma that night. And then you've got to somehow decompress and find way to turn it off. And again, that to me has got to be extremely challenging. How many hours, Adira and Risa, do you guys, both of you get per night, typically, sleep-wise?
So I'll start to say right now I'm not working shifts, so I've been able to actually see how it is when you have the ability to rely upon regular sleep and regular sleep hours. And it's been really interesting to see my mind, my body, you know, my spirit, all of it. When I was actively doing full-time clinical shifts, it was completely all over the place because not only are you sometimes working day shifts, sometimes evening shifts, sometimes overnight shift, it's that switching. And it's the switching that sort of makes your body not know what time it is. The light dark cycle gets messed up, all that stuff. So in residency, there were plenty of evenings, nights where I would work. There were plenty of evenings and nights where I would just sleep 3 to 5 hours and convince myself I did really, really well on 3 to 5 hours. Over time, and as I've aged, that's changed. You know, we've read the science. The science says 7 to 9 hours. So I aim for that. And I just think the health benefits are real.
Mm. Is that same for you,
Adira? Yeah, I would say 7 to 9. I probably barely ever hit 9. I would say I'm a consistent 7 hours, though. That is easy for me because in the mornings, my husband, I have a very helpful husband, so he helps out with the kids. And I usually get like my 7th hour during that window. But it is really important for your health. And a lot of people just assume they can sacrifice sleep. Actually, there's a lot of studies showing that, like even just working the overnight shift for doctors, like those years of doing nights takes years off of your lifespan.
Back to that big B word, burnout. No doubt that plays a part. Risa, I recall seeing something that you said too, that I think one of the things that you, I think was somebody asked you, what do you guys struggle with or what's something uncomfortable? And it's having the uncomfortable conversation, something along the lines of, you know, this is going to be awkward or having to confront somebody. Talk to us about what kind of small tasks or small tips you have for people that struggle to have the difficult conversation.
Yeah, we have a chapter on micro skills for navigating conflict, and sort of woven into that is the difficult conversation. And again, starting with stories, I worked for different supervisors who really modeled what I would say is how I don't think is the way to have the difficult conversation. Either avoiding it altogether, which basically decreased team morale, or handing it off. I had a supervisor that handed off the difficult conversation to me. I didn't realize that's what he was doing. But then literally as I was giving it or having the conversation, the other person and I bonded on the fact that we realized what he did to me and therefore to her, and you know, and ended up reflecting poorly on him. I also saw it modeled really well. I have a friend who's a chair of emergency medicine and just skillfully took on difficult conversations and conducted them, and both parties ended up feeling okay at the end of the conversation, because I think there's always a fear that you're going to feel bad or they're going to feel bad or it's going to somehow blow up. And so there's plenty of books about crucial conversations, difficult conversations, and some of the skills we talk about breaking it down of telling the reader, the listener, the audience how is number one, recognizing that there is a conflict or there's a difficulty and deciding that you're going to have the conversation. Next is role play. And this goes back to your personal board of directors and calling up your failure friend or your trust friend, and that you want to practice the conversation with them. I think there's a lot of elements of preparing yourself and preparing the person with whom you're going to be having the difficult conversation, so that, you know, in your mind, you've figured out your goal of the conversation. You've gotten permission from them to have the conversation and ensure that they feel psychologically safe having the conversation with you. And then I think an important thing that we make sure we talk about is the follow-up. It's not just a one and done. Sometimes it's a series of conversations, or sometimes if, you know, conversation 1A is started and you're not sure how it went, conversation 1B is the continuing the conversation, the follow-up, and the checking in. So there are a lot of pieces that we actually talk about throughout the book as micro skills that then build to help with that difficult conversation.
One of the things you ladies talk about is pause before accepting an opportunity. Elaborate on that, if you would.
This goes back to this, what I'm going to call a toxic phrase that I think many of us have heard, especially early in our careers, which is say yes to everything. Have you ever heard that phrase? Say yes to everything?
I think I have.
And so that often leads people to accepting, over accepting opportunities that come that way. Opportunities that they might not have even been interested in, that aren't really aligned with their skill set or their, you know, plans for growth. But you just say yes to something because you were told that you could miss out on some great opportunity if you pass something up. And so we talk a lot about in the book, this idea that you probably have heard of called FOMO, fear of missing out. And that drives a lot of us to say yes, because this could be the one thing that gets me a promotion, or maybe gets me recognized, gets me that big sale or deal I was looking for, whatever it is in your workplace. And really trying to move more towards JOMO, the joy of missing out. And this idea of just recognizing that passing up something does not mean for the rest of your life all doors are now blocked. It means that you have time to take care of the self, to take care of the work that's currently on your plate. And so one way to sort of move from FOMO to JOMO, and again, we didn't come up with those concepts, but we love them, is to inquire more about the opportunity in front of you, and to pause and to try to find the red flags. Now, you're not trying to find the red flags because you are, you know, looking for conflict or controversy. You just want to know what about something that's coming your way is going to be hard. So asking questions like, will there be funding? Is this something that's going to have admin support, or am I all on my own? Has anything like this been done before? Do you have the skills to get this done? Do I have the skills to get this done? Right? Like, just trying to figure out more and asking those questions up front versus waiting until after you say yes, weeks later, you discover, oh my gosh, the funding they told me I was going to have, actually I don't have. And now I'm 2 months in and I don't know how I'm going to take this to the finish line. And thinking, I should have had this in writing or some sort of confirmation ahead of time, right? So like, just doing your research ahead of time. And then honestly, you can take that information that you have now gathered and run it past your personal board of directors and say, you know, Risa, someone asked me about this opportunity. This is what I've learned. What do you think? Should I say yes? Should I say no? Is there anything I should ask for? Is there any way to negotiate for a better, you know, price point or something like that? But by using your network, you can come back with a more informed answer. So yeah, we really want people to push away from the impulsive yes.
Right, because the impulsive yes, to your point, if it leads to you not really being interested or it being completely different than you expected, guess what? Now you're going to disappoint everybody that you committed yes to, because you're not going to care. You're not going to put the time and energy and effort into it. And it's going to be an underwhelming experience for everybody.
And it shows almost always when someone is not interested in the work. They push the deadlines back, the timelines back. They miss out on opportunities. And so, you know, I think it's better to be more thoughtful up front and just figure out exactly if this is the right fit for you. And sometimes you might say yes, even if there's a little bit of uncertainty, but you're at least more informed.
Sure. But wouldn't you also agree that's kind of a universal truth across the board, is to kind of just pause often before just having that knee-jerk response? It doesn't have to be just yes to an opportunity. Quite often, when we have knee-jerk and quick responses, maybe if it's an emotional state that we're in, it doesn't come out right, and it ends up leading to things that you wish weren't said. So I feel like not only is it just pause before you say yes to an opportunity, but quite often just pause.
100%. And we actually talk in the book a lot about take two breaths. Take two breaths.
Absolutely. We're getting close to finishing up. I did want to ask you also, Risa and or Adira, about this. You even help out the introverts of the world. You have some advice for those folks. What would you say?
So this is a fave of mine. It's in that same chapter 8 on microskills for networking. The premise is everybody has a network. Nobody's starting from zero. And it sounds a bit creepy or superficial or inauthentic to a lot of people, networking. And sometimes we use the word connecting. Connecting might sound a little bit more benign. However, we firmly believe that networking is important. And we walk the reader through how to network. And we acknowledge in one of our microskills, networking for introverts. So I personally identify deeply as an introvert. Now, I'm not shy, I'm not socially anxious, and I can give lectures in front of hundreds, even thousands of people. And even in a room of strangers, I'm fine. However, being an introvert, and most people are familiar with the definitions now of introvert and extrovert, it refers to where you regroup, where you recharge, and also the kind of social interactions that feel better and keep you more at peace. And so early on, academic emergency medicine conferences, national conferences, they're usually get-togethers that are a lot of people, and they're loud and they're very stimulating. And, you know, I found that it didn't really socially fulfill me. And in fact, it really was a lot. And I really found myself needing to regroup and recharge. And so over time, I developed little skills that I came to find work for me. And it turns out there's a whole book on networking for people that hate networking. Actually, I'm going to read you the exact title of it. It's called Networking for People Who Hate Networking, A Field Guide for Introverts, the Overwhelmed, and the Underconnected. And it was brilliant. It actually gave a bunch of techniques about what to do. And first of all, to call it out, greater than 50% of the population identifies as an introvert. But for some reason, all of our workplaces and industries seem to reward gatherings that are for extroverts. So simple things you can do is set up one-on-one meetings, have a one-on-one coffee, have a one-on-one walking meeting. When it comes to the big conference, maybe you don't stay at the big conference hotel, but stay at one nearby that's adjacent that you can easily escape to and take a little bit of a rest. Also, rather than the huge department dinner, you know, maybe you contact people ahead of time before the meeting and said, would you like to get together for a dinner? I booked a table for four people. And sort of having those meaningful, deeper one-on-one conversations can feel more of a place of comfort for people that identify as introverted.
That's beautiful. What I find fascinating again, too, is that what you ladies are talking about, these are all small building blocks. These aren't monumental steps, but they can lead to absolute monumental victories and wins and benefits in your life. It's just stacking. It sounds like it's habit, it's routine, it's stacking. It's stacking all these little things. Like you said, don't stay at the big conference hotel where you're going to get bombarded by 1,000 people. Stay next door. And it's those little things, those little incremental things that lead to bigger successes. The book, Micro Skills, Small Actions, Big Impact. We've linked that in the show notes. Anywhere else, ladies, that you want us to direct people? We've also linked your Visible Voices podcast, Risa, for whatever that's worth. If you want to give us a little plug on the podcast and who are the folks that you're talking to?
So the Visible Voices podcast is a project that came out of COVID almost the same time Adair and I started writing together. And it's part of bringing voice and bringing visibility to subject matter experts, people doing interesting things. And also this goes to access and that everybody doesn't start at the same place, you know, visibility and voice to people that maybe aren't tapped as the subject matter experts. People don't know they're top of their field because they've basically made decisions about who has access, who has privilege. So the topics we cover are healthcare, equity, and current trends. And a lot of what Adair and I wrote about is reflected in the episodes in terms of equity, access, health, financial health. And you would ask sort of the final thing that I would like to share for the listeners and the watchers, the audience to know is just that this book we really wrote for everyone. And also, we think it speaks to the people that are ready for college, ready for work, early career. And, you know, we say this is the book we wish we had been given when we were starting our professional journey.
Gotcha. How about you, Adair? Any final thoughts from you?
First, thank you so much for having us. I agree with Risa that we really want this book to be, to feel comprehensive and full of strategies and also accessible. We hope that the reader walks away thinking, now I know how to do it. Because Risa and I have both been to lectures, workshops, seminars on all sorts of career facing goals and still left wondering, well, how do I actually do it? Like, what are the mechanics? What buttons do I press? Who do I call? And so we really wanted something that was full of nuance and details. And so we hope that that is how it resonates with our readers.
That's called more steak and maybe less sizzle, because so many people do it the other way around. So I really appreciate spending time with you two today. And like I said, wishing you guys nothing but the best. Hopefully over 1 million copies sold. That should be the target.
That'd be amazing.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you so much.